This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, World Watch President Lester Brown says in his State of the World report for 1998 that the Earth's resources are being depleted, but the attitude of some industry leaders is changing. Scientists are breeding super prawns on fish farms in Australia. New Orleanian Perry Willis presents a portrait of his special place, the Lafayette Cemetery. And in the Earth calendar, it's strawberry picking time in Florida. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Lester Brown has been studying the condition of the planet for the last 15 years. He heads the World Watch Institute and publishes annually a report entitled The State of the World. In The State of the World 1998, Brown reports the numbers are not encouraging. He thinks the world economy has outrun our resource base, but he does find hope in new attitudes, which he sees in some corporate leaders.
Almost all the vital signs, whether it's forest cover or the health of fisheries or CO2 levels in the atmosphere or the Earth's average temperature last year, all seem to be headed in the wrong direction. One of the things that's becoming much clearer now, and I think is much clearer in State of the World 1998 than it has been at any time in the past, is that the global economy, as now structured, is clearly outrunning the ecosystem. In 1950, the world produced $5 trillion worth of goods and services. In 1997, $29 trillion worth. That is to say, over roughly the last half century, the global economy has grown almost sixfold. The growth during the 7 years between 1990 and 1997 is greater than the growth from the beginning of agriculture during the 10,000 years up until 1950. I think it's difficult for us to imagine how large the economy is becoming, but the ecosystem is not getting any larger. The fish catch that the oceans could sustain today is no larger than it was in 1950. The amount of fresh water that's produced by the hydrological cycle is the same as it was in 1950. The amount of forest in the world to satisfy our needs for forest products is actually much smaller than it was in 1950, by roughly a third. So the it's becoming clear that the economy is outgrowing the ecosystem as now structured.
Brown thinks the growing Chinese economy, if it develops along Western industrialized models, will create more demands for resources than the world can supply.
What the Chinese experience is telling us is that the Western industrial development model is not viable for China. It won't be viable for India or for the other 2 billion people living in the developing world. And probably, over the long time, not viable for the industrial countries themselves. So we've got to think about building a new economic system.
One hopeful factor is new technology, which Brown thinks can give developing countries the chance to raise living standards with fewer natural resources if they could leapfrog into the future.
When we were putting in telephone systems in this country over the last, good part of a century, you know, we built, we put in telephone poles and strung wires, you know, from one house to the next until eventually the whole country was tied together by millions and millions of telephone wires. Homes and offices and what have you. But today's developing countries don't have to do that. They can use cellular phones and satellites and bypass that whole system. And that's exactly what they're doing. And so they won't have to use who knows how many million tons of copper wire to establish a phone communication system, for example. So that's an example of how technology is permitting some really dramatic jumps in materials efficiency.
Lester Brown is encouraged by what he sees as a developing trend among some major corporate leaders to recognize that it is necessary to rethink the way they do business.
More and more people are beginning to recognize that the existing industrial development model, the fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economic model that we have developed in the West is not going to work for the world over the longer term. And a lot of these people are corporate leaders. There are people like John Brown at British Petroleum, who said at a famous speech in Stanford last summer that we at British Petroleum now consider climate change as a serious threat. And we are no longer an oil company. We are now an energy company.
Lester Brown is president of the World Watch Institute, which has just released its annual report on progress toward a sustainable society. State of the World, 1998. Nineteen ninety-eight has been named the International Year of the Ocean by the United Nations. In accordance with that designation, some 1,600 scientists from 65 countries issued a warning recently stating that overexploitation of species and pollution are just two major factors threatening oceans today. Governments are being encouraged to promote oceanographic research in hopes of better understanding the world's seas. One of the countries leading the way in improving management of our seas is Australia. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on some important research being conducted in the land down under.
The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, is the federal agency in Australia responsible for environmental programs. It's a large organization with 26 departments, one of which is the Marine Research Division, where much of the country's oceanographic research is conducted. Dr. Nan Bray, a native of the United States, recently became head of the division. She now lives and works in the city of Hobart on the island of Tasmania, one of the states in Australia. Bray says aquaculture is an important part of the research CSIRO is doing.
We've been doing selective breeding of prawns, which are a very important commercial fishery in Australia, both locally within Australia and also for export to Southeast Asia. And we've developed over the last few years a substantially faster-growing, larger prawn than any other aquaculture groups in the world have been able to do. So that's really been a fairly exciting project to see come to fruition.
Bray says the new prawn was developed through breeding larger, faster-growing parents in captivity. Like government agencies in the U.S., Australia tries to balance environmental concerns with industrial growth. She says the prawn project is a good example of the applied research her division is conducting. Bray says there are a number of species currently being farmed that Australia is trying to manage more effectively.
The main commercial species are prawns in the north, in the tropics, and salmon and tuna. Around Tasmania, there's a lot of fish farms here. Also, oysters, and there's a growing abalone aquaculture industry. There's also up on our northwest shelf, which is between us and Indonesia, there's a fairly, a very lucrative pearl industry, which we don't tend to think of as aquaculture because you're not eating them, but it's a very economically a very important industry.
Besides raising better species, the agency is also looking at ways to better feed farm-raised animals. Bray says aquaculture is actually a net consumer of fish, not a net producer, because fish are needed to feed the species farmers are growing.
And so one of our other projects is aimed at developing feeds that don't involve fish meal so that aquaculture will become a net fish producer as it starts. It's presently in Australia, I think, aquaculture accounts for about 20% of the fish that's consumed, and that's going to grow because of the restrictions on fisheries. So being able to get to the point where we have feeds that don't rely on a fishing industry to provide the fish meal is going to be a very important step economically.
Fishing profits are a significant part of Australia's economy. Earnings from Australia's oceans industries are forecast to grow from $25 billion to $85 billion by the year 2020. The role of Australia's Marine Research Division is to help industry while at the same time make sure our oceans aren't being overfished and destroyed in the process. Setting quotas for Australian fishers is an important part of what CSIRO does. Dr. Bray says because of its smaller size, Australia can't afford to spend the amount countries like the U.S. spend on marine research. However, she believes each nation must do what it can to protect habitat.
People and governments are really just becoming aware of how crucial the oceans are in global climate, for instance, and in global resources, and how connected they are. So the fact that one nation is doing something really does have an influence on the other nations that are you know, both, well, really on everybody on the globe, of course, but also, for instance, the fisheries that that are international waters. If one country doesn't honor the quotas, then that has a real impact on other countries.
Among those following the lead of Australia is the United States. The country's system for managing fisheries is being used as a template by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But like most countries, Australia still has a lot to learn about our oceans. In an effort to remedy this, Australia is expected to unveil a national policy regarding the use and care of the oceans later this year. Quite appropriate in the Year of the Ocean. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production and made possible by the W. Elton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Call us at the Environment Show and let us know what you think about the environment. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Trees are a renewable resource, and theoretically, a well-managed forest can produce timber indefinitely. As consumers, we can stimulate good forestry by buying lumber or wood products that are certified as being sustainably harvested and processed. There are a number of certifiers, like the Smartwood Program of the Rainforest Alliance. They inspect the lumbering operations and operate under the umbrella of the nonprofit Forest Stewardship Council. Next time you buy wood or a wood product, or even hire a contractor, ask for certified lumber. If the seller doesn't have it in stock, you're sending the message that it should be. The Forest Service Council, or FSC, logo should be on the wood. It's a tree with a check mark on one side. Some chains, like Home Depot, carry certified lumber, and an increasing number of products are made with it. You can help save forests by insisting on certified wood.
So they just use some sort of a covering there. It's not
this
Portland cement.
Really old.
Could be.
You just don't know, do you?
No. Now look at this. This
has got. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Perry Willis, a native of New Orleans, gives us a portrait of his special place, which is the Lafayette Cemetery in the New Orleans Garden District. We walked through it together. About 8 acres in size, the cemetery is surrounded by a 10-foot-high white-gray stucco wall. Arranged in rows with walking space between them are tombs. Vaulted on top, the tombs are about as high as a person's head. Most have a carved stone plaque on one end listing names of families who have been interred. Some are still in use.
When they built the Garden District in 1832, they had to have a place to bury the dead. So in 1833, they created this cemetery. The cemetery was filled up rather rapidly because of the rapidity of death from the yellow fever and early death. So that by about 19 years later, they actually built the wall vaults.
The tombs themselves are made from brick and covered with stucco or marble. Willis explains how burial took place in spite of such limited space.
The family would buy it and they would bury someone. Now here you can only bury two people. Now at this time there was nothing done to preserve the body, so you had to have rapid burial. And they did it so that the body would rapidly deteriorate. They put them in wood coffins. And when you seal this up, it is unbelievably hot in there. And so the body deteriorates rapidly. So they allow by law at the end of 1 year and 1 day to open it up, and they push whatever's left of the body to the back, and it falls to the bottom. The bottom is dirt. It's called a caveau, which is another but a real low. It's the ground down there. And they put the next body in.
Willis says there's more to the tomb than just the vault.
Notice around it, there's a fence. All of these had fences. It was a result of when the Pontalbo building was built, and she used this beautiful designs, everyone fell in love with it. They tore down everything that was wood in the homes, and they began to put up these metal fences. Now, there are two types of metal fence. There's wrought iron, which is done by hand, and which stands up better than cast iron. But cast iron, you can get these beautiful designs without too much work, but they require more care. Now, these were like little houses, you see. They had the little grounds around them. And normally you would have the centerpiece there, but the other would be ground with grass and flowers and perhaps funeral furniture. Now, funeral furniture is what we nowadays call patio furniture. It's the type of patio furniture that's made out of iron,
yes.
Cast iron. Well, that really was intended for places to sit when you visited the dead.
The inscription on a tomb marked Sewell recalls some history of New Orleans. It says Sewell died in Shreveport, Louisiana in 1864.
As soon as the Civil War began, New Orleans was seized, fortunately. As a result, we weren't like Atlanta. We didn't lose any houses. We didn't lose anything, except the people were very upset. And Butler, when he came in, they had passed a law in Congress that you had to pledge allegiance to the United States or go to jail. Well, none of the male citizens were going to do that. The Confederacy was at its height. It couldn't begin to back away from the Confederacy, so they had to leave town. They had to go where the Union Army was not, in Shreveport, which is this little out-of-the-way, unimportant place up the river. He went there, and he died away from his home. But to make it worse, says on the 28th of the same month in the same year was killed at the Battle of New Hope Church Corporal William Washington Sewell of the 5th Company Washing Artillery, which is a New Orleans artillery, only son of Teresa J. Murray and Edward Sewell, aged 22 years and 11 months, a native of New Orleans, leaving his widowed mother childless.
New Orleanian Perry Willis is a member of the Save Our Cemetery. It's a volunteer organization which works to preserve and maintain the Lafayette Cemetery, located at Coliseum and Washington Streets in the Garden District in New Orleans. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, strawberries are being picked in Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. The strawberry has its origins in North and South America, and the fruit was brought to Europe and returned in a very different form. Most strawberry varieties being grown today have originated in the past 55 years. Bill Simmons is owner of the E.W. Simmons Farms in Clancy, Florida, located in the central part of the state, just outside of Tampa. He's growing a lot of strawberries on his 50-acre farm.
There are several different varieties. There's a new variety that's not real new, but it's been out a couple of years, that was developed here by our Dover Research Lab, part of the Florida University of Florida system, and it's called Sweet Charlie. It was named after one of the researchers that was there a few years ago. And it's acclimated to our area. There's another variety called Rosalinda that's not too widely grown, but it's one that was developed here. And the other varieties come from the University of California. They were grown for their production in California. And we kind of match up a little bit, so we can grow their varieties here. Some of the prevalent ones are Camarosa is the big one this year. Carlsbad is another one. Oso Grande is one that's been around for a while, and it's tapering down a little bit. And then there are a couple of other varieties that are not mentioned too much, but they're still grown.
In Florida, the growing season begins in October or November and lasts until April. Growers can sometimes harvest three crops in one year. Strawberries are difficult to grow in Florida because they're not a native plant. Their biggest enemies are the various types of fungi that attack the fruit. Both the type of strawberry and the weather conditions determine the sweetness of the fruit, and cooler weather that extends the growth period usually generates a better-tasting product. Bill Simmons ought to know. His family has been in the strawberry business for four generations. He says, like most industries, the process of growing strawberries has changed over the years.
When my dad and granddad grew strawberries, there was a whole different culture. Plants were grown on bare ground. They used a lot of dry fertilizer, and it was a different type of planting. Now we're using plastic culture, where we lay a plastic film. We're using a fumigation type process whenever we lay the plastic. We lay a starter fertilizer, which is a granulated mix that has all the minor elements and everything to get ready for the crop. And then we use liquid nitrogen through the season. We feed them just a little bit at a time. And we're growing on a raised bed now, to where the plants and the fruit do not touch the ground. Where in my dad's time, they used just bare dirt, so they had to wash the berries. And they put straw down whenever it got cold. They would cover them with straw to keep the frost, keep them from freezing, keep the frost off of them.
Strawberries can be stored for 5 to 7 days. Ideally, the storage temperature should be below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. But first, you have to buy your strawberries, and Bill Simmons says there are some specific things you should look for.
Well, you want to look for a strawberry that has a good green calyx around the top. You know, if it's fresh, that it'll be a real green and healthy growth on the top. And then the strawberry, you want to make sure it has a good red color to it and not a real dark. If it's real dark, it could be that it's been in storage for a long time. If it's got a real bright color to it, and you can just tell it's kind of a fresh, plump-looking type appearance to it, that's what you want to look for.
Simmons says the best way to eat a strawberry is right out of the ground, while his children enjoy making strawberry smoothies. So the next time you eat strawberries, enjoy them. But remember that beetles enjoy them too. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Let me take you down.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, Jonathan Plaut, an environmentalist who spent his career in industry, and Professor Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb, speculate on where we've been and where we're going. We talk green about auto emissions. The industry is beginning to green up its act. Author John Perkins says Amazon tribesmen can change the way we think. Stay with us. We continue our series on perspectives from the Environment Show Advisory Council. Jonathan Plaut is the former director of environmental quality of the Allied Signal Corporation. He's part of the NAFTA Commission on Environmental Cooperation and a consultant to the United Nations Environment Program. As he looks forward, he sees the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement as something that can provide real opportunity for American industry.
I think that what happened in Kyoto is a really good start, and I'm optimistic. And speaking as a member of industry, I would say that that we should have real optimism about the climate change negotiations in Kyoto. Having said that, I would also say that the success of those negotiations is still dependent on the future. The U.S. must secure commitment to the process by the lesser developed countries, in my opinion, particularly by China and Mexico. And the U.S. must also provide policy direction and stimulus for new technologies.
John, most people saw Kyoto, I think, from an industry's perspective, through the eyes of the propaganda, if you like, that the auto and energy people put out. As someone with experience in industry, you're seeing it somewhat differently.
Well, I'm guardedly hopeful. I can see the possibilities of progress using such instrumentalities as the NAFTA Joint Implementation Program, which will bring over the next year or years, will bring Mexico and the United States closer together in a cooperative relationship with relationship to climate change. And I also can see potential progress, real progress through technology, for example, through the use of things like the fuel cell, which has potentially great applicability to the automobile industry. But for those things to happen, the United States is going to have to provide leadership.
Through his work on the advisory committee to the NAFTA Commission on Environmental Cooperation, Plaut is also optimistic over environmental action on the U.S.-Mexican border.
There has been real progress in building infrastructure along the Mexican-American border under the cooperative relationship between the countries with industry support. For example, in workshops, one was held fairly recently in Brownsville, Matamoros, and that produced concrete joint programs and training. Also in grants from the Environmental Commission to support local environmental projects put forward by environmental non-governmental organizations. There have been tangible results in terms of common air sheds and watersheds, such as between El Paso and Juarez.
Environment Show advisor Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University, sees Kyoto as a useful beginning, but he takes no solace in the continuing growth of the world's population.
More happened at Kyoto than I expected to happen. At least we got a small start on what could be a gigantic problem. But in general, 1997 just showed a continuing deterioration of the entire situation and a sad escalation of the amount of nonsense published on various issues. For example, although there has been some cheering news on lower birth rates, even the most optimistic UN projections show growth continuing through the next century and adding more people to the population than were alive when I was born. And yet some people have greeted this as if we're in danger of having too small a population, you know, that we're going to run out of people. There is no danger whatsoever of running out of people. what I would expect for 1998 is more of the same. The sad thing is that that real action on global warming, on the potential there, which is about 10% of an utter catastrophe that could bring down civilization, and a, you know, 30, 40, 50% of really nasty results, will depend very largely on people's perception of the weather, which is not really the critical issue. The weather's going to vary a lot over the next decade or so. It's the trend in the climate that we have to watch, and that we should be doing something about that.
That was Professor Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb and one of the members of the Environment Show Advisory Council. We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're discussing an issue that we've heard on this program before. It's automobiles and air pollution. And we recognize that many experts think that reducing exhaust from our cars and trucks is essential if we're going to meet the commitments that the country made to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at Kyoto. It's also, of course, a key factor in the quality of air in cities and our public health. So the question is how to bring this about. How do we meet the Kyoto targets, at least as it relates to participation by the auto manufacturers? Will the companies do this on their own, or do they need to be pushed through stricter regulation? Let us know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests are two favorites for the Environment Show. One is Dan Becker. He's the director of the Sierra Club Global Warming and Energy Program. He joins us from Washington. And the other is Dr. Richard Klemisch. He's an engineer with the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, and he is one of those who is credited with developing the catalytic converter. He joins us from Detroit. Gentlemen, welcome back to the Environment Show.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Dr. Klemisch, let me start with what may sound like a nasty question. Before Kyoto, the basic position of the auto manufacturers, as I understood it, was that consumer demand had made it very difficult to clean up the sport utility and pickup truck product because to do so would be too expensive, both in terms of cost and in performance. And the manufacturers also said that hybrid vehicles, which could double our fuel efficiency or more, were basically years away in terms of development. Now, in the last 3 months, or since we spoke, as I understand it, Ford says that it's going to build pickup and sports utility vehicles next year, which would meet the tougher standards of automobiles. And Toyota has a hybrid on the market, which is selling in Japan now for less than $18,000. If this kind of thing is going on, does the industry have any credibility when it comes to talking to Congress about where we go next on auto exhaust emissions?
Well, I hope so. Your story has got a whole bunch of errors in it.
Great. Okay.
In fact, you know, before Kyoto, we haven't really changed our position on any of this. Fundamentally, there's two issues here. One is the CO2 issue, the greenhouse gas emissions issue, which was what Kyoto was all about. Fundamentally, the use of fuel is related to the price of fuel, and the marketplace in the U.S. and in some other places, Europe especially, is towards bigger vehicles. The U.S. consumers don't value fuel economy very highly. The other issue is the pollutants, the carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, and nitrogen oxides, and that's what the Ford announcement was about. And another number of other companies have announced voluntarily reducing these emissions. CO2 is a tougher one, and the hybrids, the ultra lightweight vehicles, the fuel cells, all that's directed at trying to make some of these gains in CO2. The fundamental problems with those is cost. And the other fundamental problem is the low fuel prices in the U.S. don't provide much incentive for customers to go for those kinds of extra costs.
Before we get to Don Becker from Sierra, is better performance, which may be necessary both to deal with nitrous oxides and with CO2, something that can happen most rapidly by itself, or in order to push this thing along, is it necessary basically for tighter requirements and regulation imposed by the government?
No, I don't think, ultimately trying to force technology before it's ready will backfire and be counterproductive. The marketplace has got to demand, especially fuel economy advances. That just doesn't work if you try to regulate that. The disastrous program of CAFE regulations, I think, proved that.
Okay, well, those sounds like fighting words. Dan Becker, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think Detroit deserves some credit for making cars a little bit cleaner, or at least promising to. And I think it's a step forward that Detroit has begun to listen to the American people, because the American people do want cleaner cars. We want to buy vehicles that provide us with an efficient and clean way of moving from place A to place B that doesn't jeopardize the future for our children. And the global warming problem is a major threat to the future of our planet. And during our children's lifetimes, it's going to significantly change the climate here on Earth unless we stop polluting now. And so I think that Detroit deserves a cheer or two for taking steps in the right direction. I think Dr. Klemisch is right that right now gas prices are cheaper than bottled water and not sending a price signal. But I think I disagree with him when he says that you can't regulate given that situation. We know, for example, that back when that radical environmentalist Gerald Ford of Michigan signed the original CAFE law, the mile per gallon law, in 1975, that cars were getting 14.5 miles per gallon on average. Now they're almost double that. Now, we've been moving in a weird direction with these sport utility vehicles, but I think the American people don't know that those are as polluting as they are. And so I think it's a step forward for us to try to address the pollution problem. And in fact, given that more carbon dioxide pollution spews out of our tailpipes of our cars and sport utility vehicles than out of all sources in all of Japan combined, we've got to take steps right now to begin to address that problem. And the biggest single step we can take is to raise that mile per gallon law so that cars and trucks go further on a gallon of gas.
I know that, Dick Klemisch, you will say that the market signals are the thing that make a difference. In your judgment, if one wanted to attack this problem, would it make more sense to raise the gas tax than to increase fuel per gallon standards, or is there some other way of doing this?
No, at the end of the day, the only way to do this is to raise the prices. In the long term, we can hope that technology will develop that won't be any more expensive than the conventional technology. That's probably wishful thinking, at least in our lifetimes. If you look at every place around the world, I think Lee Shipper from University of California has done an interesting plot that shows that fuel use per capita is directly related to the price of fuel.
But let me ask you something about the technology, because what you say is that it's a long way off. And I think a lot of the public believes that the auto companies are always saying technology is a long way off, when indeed it happens a lot more rapidly, either because people don't want to acknowledge that it's here already or that it becomes expensive. If you look at the fights, and this goes beyond the auto industry, about the Clean Air Act, every time somebody talks about tougher standards, the manufacturers tend to say the economy is going to shut down, and then guess what? In just a few years, they've met them and exceeded them because of this tremendous capacity that perhaps we inappropriately take for granted that the American industrial process has for innovation and new technology.
Well, that's part of the mating dance of the whole regulatory process. The government typically makes proposals that are beyond technological innovation, and it's our job to say, if you go that far, it'll be counterproductive, and we generally end up at some compromise. But the government, we usually allow the government at the end of the day to say they won, because there's not much point in arguing about that. But that's just the ritual that we've gone through in this country, the way we set up these kinds of negotiations.
But Dick, this is a real threat to your industry, to the auto industry. I was in Japan for this Kyoto meeting, and there was a clean car auto show that the Japanese manufacturers put on, and they had 66 mile per gallon vehicles that were on sale, are on sale now in Japan, and have sold out in the first months that they're being offered. And I sat in it and watched it, and it was a very impressive vehicle. There's a fuel cell vehicle there that has zero emissions. The only thing it emits is water, and we mm-hmm. like water. Water's okay. So that, and I've ridden in a fuel cell vehicle, and the technology does exist. You got to move it into the vehicles that we make in this country, or we'll end up buying them all from Japan or somewhere else. And that would be bad, both for the environment, because it won't happen quickly enough, and for our jobs in this country.
Well, you know, that Toyota, the Toyota announcement, they originally announced that they were going to sell that in the U.S. They've now said they have to redesign it, and they've admitted that the vehicle costs of the order of $42,000, and they're selling it for $16,000.
Well, I met with the engineer who was
and,
in charge.
Wait a minute.
More than $17,000.
I'm sorry, you're wrong on that. And if you heard about the Detroit Auto Show, there were a number of such vehicles announced that will be on the road here within the next couple of years. And we intend to beat the Japanese into the market with fuel cells and with hybrid vehicles. But we don't expect those to make a significant impact in the market at dollar a gallon gasoline. And it's, you know, there's just no incentive for customers to do that.
So what is the auto industry doing to raise the price of gasoline, to raise gas taxes, if that's what you think is the solution?
Well, that's, you know, the question is, if we decide that as a nation that's a top priority for us, then we have to do that. Politically, that's a very difficult issue, and our position has been that if the country decides we need a drastic reduction in fuel use, then we have to make the political decision to raise the price of fuels, and we'll support that. But at this point, the government hasn't decided to do that.
If one wants to substantially advance the technology here, advance it in terms of getting it into the marketplace, that jacking up the gas tax is the only way to get there on the most accelerated basis that's practical?
Yeah, and well, that won't do it by itself either. I mean, it is the hope that these technologies, if supported through this initial price barrier, will become competitive. To compete with conventional technology, they have to be competitive price-wise, or there has to be some incentive for customers to buy them. Certainly higher fuel prices help that a lot. So we expect to see these technologies elsewhere in the world.
I'm afraid our time is up. This is an issue that we'll be coming back to. It's certainly not an easy one, and there's no simple answer. We've been talking green about auto emissions and cleaning up the air. My guests have been Dan Becker from the Sierra Club and Richard Klemisch from the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. We want to know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear the Environment Show anytime on your personal computer, and also send us a message through our webpage. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Author John Perkins has completed his latest work entitled Shapeshifting, Shamanic Techniques for Global and Personal Transformation. Perkins is a former president of an energy company in the United States, but now he's focusing his attention on the environment. He believes Amazon tribesmen can show modern folk how to change the path of consumption and destruction that we seem to be on. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with Perkins about the book.
What is a shapeshifter and what is shape shifting? Is it projection, visualizing something happening, or is it the entire notion that man is part of the earth and always will be and has always been part of the natural world?
Well, Steve, I think of shape shifting as occurring really on three levels. One is the cellular shape shift. And that is when a shaman actually becomes something else, let's say a jaguar or a plant. And it also occurs in us all the time. As we're growing older, we're going through cellular shape shifts.
Let's just look at that for a moment. When you say actually become a jaguar, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean exactly that. I've sat next to a shaman in the Amazon, and at a fire with other people from my culture, scientists and medical doctors, and seeing this man get up from his stool, go out the door, and as he goes out the door, become a jaguar and run into the forest. I know that sounds outrageous from our cultural perspective, but I've seen it happen and been with other people who've seen it happen. And I describe in the book Shapeshifting a very wise man in Indonesia who I was there when he became a bush. He shapeshifted into a bush. Now, the theory behind that from a shamanic standpoint is that energy and matter, very close to our scientific theory, energy and matter never leave the planet. They just change forms. And we are all made of energy and matter. And our thoughts, our ideas, our beliefs are also energy. And these have a tremendous effect on us. So we can actually change forms through a process of using intent, belief, faith. We can actually physically change forms. And our medical science today has many cases on records of cancers being cured, and getting a cancer is a shapeshift, and getting rid of a cancer is a shapeshift, of things like this happening, of cancers being cured by people who use a lot of prayer, a lot of strong belief.
In the book, you touch on some of the many a number of primitive societies or tribes that remain. For example, I guess it's the Shuar? The Shuar,
yes.
Okay. They're known for headhunting and shrinking the heads of enemies. That's mentioned in the book. What can they teach us about life on Earth, since many people would probably consider them far too primitive to teach us anything?
While our goal, it appears, has been to change the environment around us, their goal has been to work more closely with it. And they certainly have done things to change it to some degree. They've become great cultivators of, for example, in the Amazon, they've become great cultivators of forest products, trees, fruits, vegetables, that type of thing in the forest. But there's been quite an evolution. Now, I think what they have to teach us today is how we can take what we've achieved, and I think the microchip, for example, gives us tremendous potential in this regard, how we can take what we've achieved and tie it back into a philosophy that's much more sustainable, that's closer to living with nature, to living with everything that's around us, rather than feeling that we constantly have to change what's around us. Because I think today we are all reaching the conclusion that if we don't live closer to nature, there's not going to be a long future for human civilization as we know it today.
Now, you're trying to bring this message to business leaders and people in the corporate world to perhaps try and change the way they are thinking. How difficult is that, and how are you going about doing that?
What happened at the Kyoto conference in Japan in this last month of December is incredibly significant. The whole world, the leaders of the whole world, got together and said, we're going to do something to cut back on greenhouse gases. It was very bold and very, very significant. And now the whole world's going to have to discuss these policies. We in the United States are going to have a very
intense discussion about how the Senate is going to react to this, whether it's going to be ratified or not. And this process is going to force us all to really look at what is it we want out of life. You know, we've worked under this assumption that what we want is more and more things taken out of Mother Earth, ground up, molded, and put in our houses. More material things, bigger houses, bigger cars, using more and more fuel. And we're now looking into our lives and saying, but we're not very happy. And we look at the statistics, and although we're the wealthiest country that's ever existed on this planet, statistically we appear to be the least happy. We have the highest divorce rates and suicide rates and drug abuse rates and violence and murder rates. And I think we're all looking at this and saying, well, where are we and what do we really want? And the executives at the top of these big companies are doing exactly the same things.
That was author John Perkins discussing his new book, Shapeshifting, Shamanic Techniques for Global and Personal Transformation. It's published by Destiny Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Every gourmet cook needs this program to prepare prawns with fresh strawberries, especially if you cook them in the Amazon. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 422. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Steve Whateley is technical engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.